from SDPB Radio. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Governor Kristi Noem, in her budget address Tuesday, announced $9 million in reductions to state agencies. Money is tight this year, prefaced Noem. The Dakota Political Junkies discussed the governor's proposed 2021 budget. They also visit about the resignation of Minnehaha County State's Attorney Aaron McGowan. County commissioners approved a $35,000 payment in exchange for his resignation. Jonathan Ellis, investigative reporter for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, and John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, visit with In the Moment host Lori Walsh.
Let's start with the state budget. John Hunter, what were some of the things we were kind of looking for? This is actually Governor Noem's second state budget because she did a state budget proposal. She kind of came out last year with one, and now this is her first on her own. Anything that you were anticipating going in?
Well, we'd heard things in advance of this. I think probably they may have leaked that intentionally, that the budget was going to be tight, that tax revenues were coming in slightly below forecast for the year that we're in, that ends June 30th, 2020. And so usually when that happens, that means the next year forecast might get trimmed a little bit too. So I think we were preparing a little bit for some austerity, and that I think is essentially what was delivered. So and from that sense, it wasn't a surprise, but it is not a robust spending plan.
Jonathan Ellis, this seems like something we kind of hear every year, that that the budget's going to be tight. But this year there were some specific things that have kind of caused the crunch, one of them being an international trade war.
International trade war, commodity prices are low. That obviously affects, a large segment of our economy, if not the largest segment of our economy. So that affects then, of course, sales tax revenues, which is the lifeblood of how we fund government services in this state, as opposed to, say, having an income tax. And then also, there was a predicted. I mean, we knew that South Dakota was going to lose a revenue source via the federal government. South Dakota has been a state that has taxed internet access services, of course, because we tax all services. And we were one of just a handful of states that allowed that tax. And the federal government has been trying to abolish that tax for years, and finally went ahead, and we've been grandfathered in all these years, and finally they've ended that tax. States are allowed to have that tax. So we knew that was coming, and sort of the exchange there is that we knew we would also get some additional revenues from taxing sales tax, internet purchases. So there was some trade-off here and there, but we knew that big internet access tax would be coming to an end, and so that was foreseeable. And as John said, we could kind of predict that there would be some austerity coming.
And as we look at that that tax going away, not so great for the state budget coffers, but John Hunter, it's really tax relief for South Dakotans who pay for internet service, right?
Right. I think they're trying to emphasize that, too, that $30 million or so would be in consumers' pockets, those people, and most people purchase internet access in some form or another. About two-thirds of that would go to the state, so $20 million. But municipalities will end up having slightly lower taxes from this as well. But I think you could equate that to a tax cut. It wasn't voluntary necessarily for it, but it is a reduction in tax. And in a lot of cases, that can stimulate an economy, even in small ways.
Right. Governor Noem made clear at the beginning that she was not going to give us a comprehensive line-by-line look at everything in her budget proposal, but we could tell what her priorities are by the things that she did highlight. John Hunter, what stood out to you?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Lori, because that's, I think, true to what she has been saying. And that's really what stuck with me with the budget address, is like, these are the things that I campaigned on. These are the things that I believe in, that I've been saying. And so we're going to back that up. And so certainly the attacking the meth epidemic, as it's described in South Dakota, is putting money toward that, toward trying to getting broadband internet access to rural areas in South Dakota. She has been talking about that. So those are clearly priorities. And I think, an emphasis on foster care. She really, I think, has a an interest in the next generation. She's campaigned on that she would try to work all her policies with the future in mind. And so I think she did that. And so any of the kind of new items or extraordinary items, either we're dealing with things that she has talked about or, in general, generations to come.
Right. And that math conversation does harken back to the election and campaign promises, especially in the sense of treatment, not just enforcement, but Jonathan Ellis, she's asking for money for treatment and enforcement here, as well as we've all been talking about the campaign for awareness. So three-legged stool here. What did you notice about what she was saying about meth as far as, this is her time as well to lay out why this is such a problem in South Dakota, which a lot of people maybe didn't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think she talked about how meth, a startling statistic was that, youth in the state are reporting using that in the last year, using that drug more than the national average, twice the national average, which I think anybody who understands, methamphetamine and what it does, that's a startling statistic right there.
Right.
And so, obviously, she's trying to attack that. And we've all talked about the controversial ad campaign, but that was a priority, and then she's definitely doubling down on that and putting more money into that area.
John Hunter, let's talk about things like the money headed to bolster cybersecurity, because that directly affects Madison.
It does. Right, and I think economic development that goes with that, too. She earmarked about $400,000 for an incubator, which would create jobs coming out of the cybersecurity. We know what's going on at Dakota State is preparing students for this exploding industry. I mean,
right.
You just couldn't imagine the demand for these graduates. The government certainly, but all private industry, they're just eager to get these cybersecurity things. So rather than having companies from Baltimore or from Virginia take all the graduates, best and brightest from South Dakota, that she and others, myself included, would love to keep those jobs in South Dakota. And as you know, that cybersecurity work certainly could be done from anywhere. It is done from anywhere, and the attacking is done from anywhere.
Right.
So we think South Dakota is a great place to do that, and so she is designating some money for that.
Also in this area of what she's calling next generation industries is investment in healthcare training for the medical field. And let's talk a little bit about education, because that could be controversial to some. She said, no raises for state employees and teachers, but that money is going to go to, different areas. Jonathan, do you think state employees and teachers and, providers are going to be satisfied with that?
One word answer, no.
Nope.
But, I think that, I think that what this does is probably opens the door for lawmakers to come in and be the, be the good guys, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, they'll maybe find some funding. I think, even a 1% increase for all of those areas, I mean, it's probably within the scope of what they can do. It's interesting that this budget, does take kind of the blueprint of the Dennis Dugard budget versus the way Mike Rounds would budget. And so it includes no reserve money to balance next year's budget. Mike Rounds would occasionally do that. He would use reserve money for ongoing spending. She did propose some reserve money for the current year, but that again is kind of in the mold of Dennis Dugard. It was kind of, most people would say it's much more fiscally conservative, a mold in which you don't rely on reserves for next year's spending.
All right. She did mention long-term care services, which, again, many people are not going to say or are going to say is not enough. But mental health was not on there. There was no slide in the priorities for mental health services and beds. After the summer study for lawmakers, I thought that was an interesting omission. John Hunter, any other things that she didn't put in her priorities that you thought were noteworthy?
Well, if I may, Lori, I'd like to back up just on your comment right there on mental health services and elder care and all sorts of kind of addiction treatment and so forth. Those we can allocate money to those, and I think she did in this budget address. But I think there's something behind that that's still hard. Is it we don't have those professionals available. We can say let's spend an extra $5 million on treatment. Well, we don't have treatment professionals available, and so you do have to take one step back and somehow encourage high school students to consider that as a college discipline and to consider that as a career and so forth. So that's not something you can do in 1 year. But I think the methamphetamine certainly demands a lot of counseling and all the care that goes with breaking that addiction. And I think there's just a plain shortage of professionals in that area in South Dakota. I think it is, regardless of the money and doing sending money to that area, I think we need professionals to people to do that.
So, John, the investment in $5 million towards construction of a new school of health sciences building at USD, is that addressing that in some way, or is that a separate conversation, do you think?
No, I think it is. I think it is. Not necessarily mental health or addiction services, but all sorts of growth areas. And we're blessed, I think, in South Dakota, if that's the correct term, I don't know, but to have two major health systems in South Dakota plus a major health system in the west part of the state that can offer student opportunities, practicums. You know, the USD certainly can place, or any other people who want to get into healthcare, there are plenty of those placements available in South Dakota. The future jobs are in South Dakota. It's a great industry for us. You know, if you're at Gustavus Adolphus, let's say in Minnesota, they can't put a nursing program together because they don't have a hospital that would allow those practicums to take place. But in South Dakota, we're full of opportunities. So yes, I do think that the addressing the health sciences area at USD is a great investment, and hopefully that will produce students, graduates, career people who will fill needs that South Dakota has in the future.
Jonathan, anything that you thought that was omitted, at least in the priorities area of the conversation, that you found noteworthy?
Well, this budget address was different than, again, going back to Dennis Dugard, who would his budget addresses would be very long and quite detailed. And this one, I think, would be summed up as, it was brevity. And so... there are probably a lot of details that we have to get into it and explore the details. And I know that lawmakers on the Appropriations Committee are going to be doing that. So there are probably going to be some things in here that we have that weren't highlighted that we will have to take a look at. So there's more, because this was a shorter kind of higher level budget address than what we're used to from the previous 8 years of Dennis Dugard. There's more to look at, I guess, in this budget. You got to open the hood of this thing and tinker with it.
Right, and she did mention in her opening remarks, opensd.gov, and the goal for more greater transparency with how many of those slides are available. Are you noticing, Jonathan, a measurable difference in transparency with this administration?
I would not. I mean, I have not been in a position to test that. I think that Dennis Dugard was very transparent, especially on budget issues. So I can't say one way or another.
John Hunter, any thoughts on that, on transparency? Are we seeing a change?
I'm kind of formulating my opinion as well. I think Governor Noem has been eager to be transparent and has worked with agencies have done that. So in general, I would give a good score to that. Again, following Dennis Dugard, who was also made transparency a priority, I would probably give them both good grades at this point. But I think I'm still formulating an opinion on that.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about another top political news story, and that is Minnehaha County State's Attorney Aaron McGowan. We've spoken about him on this program before. Jonathan Ellis has covered it along with his colleagues at the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. You can find all that coverage at argusleader.com. $35,000 and an agreement to step away. Jonathan, what's the latest on this agreement between McGowan and the county commissioners?
Well, there is an agreement in place. It called for a one-time payout of $35,000, and there's some releases in there about who can sue, not being allowed to sue the county. We don't know. They're talking about transparency. There's been very little transparency about what led up to this, but we do know that there wouldn't have been an agreement without some kind of negotiation that took place. And there was obviously a reason that the county commission was willing to pay McGowan to leave.
Right.
It's odd that an elected official would get money to resign, but in this case, he did. And there was obviously a reason for that.
Right. And this became a risk management issue. So for background and clarity, he's been with the state's attorney. He's been the Minnehaha County state's attorney, an elected official for 11 years. In July, Argus Leader reported on his absence from work after some knee surgeries, unexplained absences. As those stories unfolded, South Dakota Attorney General Jason Roundsburg and DCI conducted an investigation. And then there's another investigation. Jonathan, paint the picture of risk management, and who is this this other investigative body?
Well, the county became alarmed at what was disclosed within Attorney General Ronsberg's investigation, in particular an incident that was highlighted with a female employee, there was a strong suggestion that there was some inappropriate behavior that took place there. I think the county, recognizing that it's on the hook liability-wise for misconduct issues immediately.
And this was specifically, she gets a day off in exchange for bringing alcohol to his house. We should be specific about what happened with the female employee.
At the very least, it was a quid pro quo of, I'll give you a day off if you buy me a bottle of booze and let me come over and drink it. At the very least, it's a quid pro quo. There was also, again, some undertones, maybe some other stuff, going on. And so the county, recognizing the liability issue following the release of that report, asked its own risk management, and I should say that this is not the county. There was a media report that sort of tried to undercut our reporting. I don't know why they are doing that, but in which they said the county is not investigating. Well, of course, the county has an insurance company that does that, and it's an Aberdeen law firm that specializes in employment law issues, and certainly they were brought in to assess what was going on. Not just on sexual harassment issues, some other issues, but primarily focusing on the treatment of potentially female employees in that office. My understanding is that there were not a great number of interviews conducted in there, both with current and former employees, and there were some big red flags that came out of those interviews.
So county commissioners are really focusing on the future and the employees of the state's attorney's office, saying these people have been through a lot lately and we're hoping to move forward. How long, Jonathan, before they can get a replacement in for Aaron McGowan?
I think it'll be fairly quick. The office, I think they laid out the time frame of about 2 weeks. I think that's a fairly quick turnaround. There are some highly experienced prosecutors within that office, so I don't think they have to go far to find somebody who would be very capable of taking over.
John Hunter, the story continues to unfold that we've been covering and talking about really since, for weeks now. And any final thoughts before we close the book on today's conversation about Aaron McGowan?
Well, I think the $35,000 payment, I think, might be slightly different than presented. And that is, I don't believe it was a payment to ask him to resign. I think it was a payment to release the county from any future action that may go with that. So you never know how the legal world works, but if you looked at that agreement, it said, kind of in exchange for this money, you agreed never to do this and this and this and this and this, a long list of things pursuing you know, saying whether it's wrongful termination or, you know, who knows what would be there. So I think the $35,000 was less. I think he was going to resign anyway. I think the $35,000 was more for releasing, trying to get, and it may have been recommended by this alliance, the insurance alliance, in order to put an end to possible liabilities.
All right, and we don't know, as Jonathan said, what all went into that negotiation, what was said, what was unsaid. We'll continue to follow the story, and you can follow Jonathan Ellis at argusleader.com. And John Hunter at, remind me your website, please.
Daily Leader Extra.
Thank you. DailyLeaderExtra.com in Madison. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori. Yeah, thank you, Lori.
Continuing the conversation about Governor Kristi Noem's budget address, SDPB's Lee Strubinger, who was at the address, joined us to discuss what he heard.
Lee, thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be here.
All right. Governor Noem is calling it a lean year for state government. What's driving that?
Well, the hit that the state took in the ag sector this year with the trade wars, the weather, rain and flooding. Noem is anticipating about $6 million in a revenue decrease this current fiscal year, but about $28 million increase next fiscal year. The biggest chunk out of the general fund between fiscal years is anticipating an upcoming federal legislation that really impacts the state budget. So starting in July, the state will lose the ability to tax internet access services. This was legislation that was driven by Senator John Thune. He introduced it in 2015, and it eliminated a grandfather clause in federal law that allows states to tax for that service. So starting July 1st, the state can no longer seek that tax. And Noem says last year, they thought the impact to the state budget would be less.
Originally last year, during legislative session, we thought the implementation of the Internet Tax Freedom Act would hit the state budget at about $10 to $15 million. And from doing more research over the last 12 months, we found that it's actually larger than that. So that's why you'll see a $30 million tax burden relief from South Dakota families. $20 million of that will come off the state's revenue, which means we need to reduce that spending as well.
Some lawmakers anticipate freeing up that $30 million in additional revenue could lead to some increased economic activity. Noem is anticipating an increase of $36.6 million in sales and use tax from fiscal year 20 to fiscal year 21.
All right. Governor Noem is recommending a smaller budget next fiscal year, but you're saying the state is anticipating an increase in sales tax collection.
Sure. So real quick, you know, about a third of the budget is federal funds. Another third of the budget is called general funds. And about another third of the budget is what we call other funds. And so I reached out to Liza Clark, who is the head of the Bureau of Finance and Management. She said those other funds are largely due to special appropriations for the Board of Regents that passed last year and other funds that are derived from other sources of revenue, general and federal sources, special taxes and fees and those sorts of things. So there's about $57.4 million decrease from fiscal year 20 to fiscal year 21. But the general funds is what the state is mostly in charge of, which is about $1.7 billion. And a lot of that budget is already put in place. The reduction in the overall budget is coming largely from that other funds category.
No recommendation for cost of living adjustment for state employees, education, and providers. Did she expand on that decision?
She did. During a press conference following the governor's budget address, she says in lieu of those inflation increases, her office found other areas in education and provider funding the state needs to address. She says the money is heading to education, but just not the inflationary increase, which the state law is either 3% or the rise of inflation, whichever is less. The state is seeing more K through 12 enrollment increases, which they say is projected to increase by approximately 1%. Noem says about $1 million. That's a cost of about $1 million. She's also proposing adjustments of $14 million for special education. She's proposing $4.1 million for the employee health plan, and she says she wants to focus on the family leave policy for employees. I spoke with State Senator Reynold Nesiba following the budget address, and he's a Democrat from Sioux Falls. He says he's worried about what he calls a wage cut on state employees, educators, and medical providers.
That inflation's been at 1.5%. If we fail to give them a cost of living adjustment, that means they're moving backwards. It wasn't that many years ago that we were 50th in the country in terms of teacher pay. And our failure to keep up, we're going to be right back at 50th place again. And that's not where we want to be. South Dakota's better than that, and our kids deserve better.
Nesiba, also said, when it comes to the fiscal year 2021 budget, appropriators are forecasting 18 months ahead. And so he says there will likely be some mid-course corrections, he called it.
The governor is recommending $3.7 million for meth treatment and enforcement. What do we see that money going toward? What does she propose that money should go toward?
Sure. $3 million of that, she says she wants to go towards treatment facilities, and $700,000 of that to go to law enforcement. So last session, Noam asked for funding for 4 highway patrol troopers to specifically focus on meth, as well as 2 DCI agents to focus on investigations and meth trafficking through the state. She says she wants the tools necessary to go after the issue with law enforcement, but that the $3 million is designed specifically for meth treatment. She says most federal dollars are targeted towards opioids.
And we do have opioid addiction problems in the state of South Dakota, but overwhelmingly our problem is still meth. About 80%, and even more than that, that go through our court system that have addiction issues, over 80% of them have to do with meth. So that's why in my budget I've made it a priority to make sure that we're funding treatment, because as we've seen more and more requests come in, and more people contacting the helpline and accessing the website, we want to make sure we actually have places that we can place them to get the kind of help that they need.
So during the summer study this year, the Division of Behavioral Health surveyed 12 of their contracted agencies that provide publicly funded residential treatment services, or meth treatment. And they wanted to understand the demand for those services. And based on the results, and these numbers are coming from the Department of Social Services, they estimated a need of 55 low-intensity residential treatment services beds and 21 intensive inpatient beds for an estimated cost of about $3.3 million. And so the governor is proposing almost as much as what Department of Social Services said was their need. I asked Republican Speaker of the House, Stephen Haugaard, who chaired the Offenses Regarding Controlled Substances Committee this summer. I asked him if that $3.7 million for intensive meth treatment and enforcement was enough.
Well, you can always say you need more, but as far as the number of beds needed and the treatment costs associated with that, we need to fine-tune those numbers, but those are getting into the right category. At least that shows that we have an opportunity to get people into a longer-term care and actually see them succeed in their recovery.
Now, Governor Noam is also pointing to $5.1 million to improve the state radio infrastructure for law enforcement and first responders, $5 million for what she calls the Connect South Dakota Initiative, Internet into Rural Communities. Absent from that budget address was talk of collections from remote sellers and potential changes to the Partridge Amendment. It seems like that was all we were talking about not too long ago. Why was that absent from her budget address proposal?
Noam says the state did not see revenues coming in the door from online sales tax collections that would trigger a reduction to the sales tax rate. Mm-hmm. The Partridge Amendment, real quick, is a mechanism in state law that reduces the state sales tax by 0.1% for every $20 million in online revenue raised. She says the $20 million threshold was never met, and that could have been for several reasons. But her budget proposal didn't reflect it because the statute didn't get triggered by the amount that was coming in the door. Noam says there's uncertainty in how to account for where sales tax is coming from and how it's defined.
I'm sure that will be a debate that legislators will have. It's something that we've talked about for several legislative sessions now, and that they'll be bringing something forward as far as ideas. And as the appropriators dig into the actual dollars, they'll find out exactly where revenue is coming from and the fact that it wasn't as much as they had originally anticipated.
Despite that, during the executive board meeting among lawmakers yesterday morning before the budget address, the Partridge Amendment and online collections came up. Generally speaking, you have 2 philosophies on how to handle that amendment. Senate Republicans are saying it's a shift in spending and therefore kind of a wash. House Republicans are pushing to tie the amendment to an overall increase in revenue and not just internet revenue to trigger that sales tax reduction.
The South Dakota Science and Technology Authority has signed a cooperative agreement with the Department of Energy's Office of Science. Now, federal money will flow into the Sanford Underground Research Facility's operations in Lead. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
Mike Headley is the executive director of the South Dakota Science and Technology Authority.
This is a really, really big deal for South Dakota. These cooperative agreements like this are fairly rare at this scale.
Currently, it takes more than $20 million per year to operate the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Those expenses rose about $7 million in nearly 3 years.
We've really, for a number of years, have kind of operated on a bit of a shoestring budget. And so with Sanford Lab being expected to operate in a reliable way that really supports the science well, there are areas where we needed to add additional resources. And so it's not only providing sufficient staff to do that, but supplies and equipment to do that, and also improving some of our aging infrastructure to be able to operate reliably into the future.
The cooperative agreement funds more than $123 million split over 5 years. That covers operational costs and improvements to the lab's infrastructure. Headley says that agreement shows that the lab's work on experiments like neutrinos have a place on the world stage.
The prominence of the Sanford Lab here in South Dakota is just increasing exponentially with the type of work we're doing. In recognition of that and our important role in DOE's science mission, that's really one of the big drivers as to why they wanted to work directly with us for the success of their mission.
Headley says it makes a big impact on the local economy and job market. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
South Dakota Voices for Peace has been awarded the National JMK Innovation Prize for their work on immigration issues. Taniza Islam, Executive Director for South Dakota Voices for Peace, and Amy Freitag, Executive Director of the J.M. Kaplan Fund, joined In the Moment to discuss South Dakota Voices for Peace and their efforts.
Amy, I want to start with you and put this prize in some context, because there aren't many organizations throughout the country who have been, who are on this very select list. Tell us about the prize and what you're looking for as you search for innovation.
Well, this is the third round of the JMK Innovation Prize. We started it in 2015, and we do it every other year. And basically, our goal was to reach out across the country and find really game-changing early-stage organizations that could take a real, we could really invest in for 3 years to lift up their work and really help them get to their goal. And so we had about 1,354 applications, to be exact, come in this year, and we're really excited. The South Dakota Voices for Peace is among those top 10 winners from that group of 1,354 applicants.
So I'm going to let Nisa talk about the organization for a bit, and then Amy, I'm going to ask you, what stood out for you about South Dakota Voices of Peace. But Nisa, for people who don't know what this organization does, tell us a little bit how you got started, because you're living in South Dakota as a fairly new, you moved here relatively recently to the state, and found out some things that were happening in Pierre and became more of an advocate here in the state than you had been before.
Sure. Well, I'm an immigration lawyer, and I've done civil rights work back when I was in Minnesota. So I think that foundation has really catapulted the work that we're doing today. So in 2017, I received some phone calls from my fellow lobbyists in Pierre who said that they were starting to see some really ugly bills about Muslims, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee bills up there. Well, I did that work for about 8 years when I was in Minnesota. And when we moved here in 2012, I reshifted. I was a new mom, so I wasn't doing that work, and no one knew I did that work here except for a select few. So I did what I know to do, which is to organize the community, and we took impacted communities who would be immigrants, refugees, and Muslims to peer just to be present and to be able to testify on what the impact of some of these anti-Muslim immigrant bills would be. So since 2017, we have defeated 10 out of the 12 bills and resolutions that have been proposed. So our group really came together organically to fight those bills, but after session was done in March, we started to see it's because we were paying attention. We started to track anti-Muslim immigrant refugee events in our state, and to date, we've tracked over 36 such events. So this organic group, we came together and said, hey, I think we need to stay together and figure out what we can do about these issues. And so we incorporated with the state in October of 2017 and hit the ground running with education and rapid response work, because there was a lot of things we were reacting to in the community that was happening on a federal level as well as a regional and state level. And then we slowly just started to gel, you know, and think about what our programming is. And then today we now have four main programming areas, which is education to the public. We do a lot of myth busting, if you will, on immigration law policies, as well as Muslims, who we are as a faith community and who we are here in South Dakota. Our kind of flagship program within education has been our storyteller program. So we really lift the voices of our amazing Muslim immigrant and refugee community members. So we're creating that platform for them. All of our stories can be found on our website and Facebook page, but we've lifted the voices of seven people so far, and we hope to do more and more as we get more and more money like this prize to do that work. We also just launched our legal services program. As you mentioned in the opening, we have over 500 unaccompanied minors from Central America that have been released to South Dakota. People are really shocked to hear that. But we believe that we can make most impact in providing direct legal services, no cost to these children. They're all in immigration court. And we know with a lawyer, they have a 60% chance of obtaining a path to citizenship and becoming a productive and valued member of our community, so they don't have to stay in the shadows. So that's where what we're doing.
Amy, tell me a little bit about what stands out about an organization like South Dakota Voices for Peace that connects with the J.M. Kaplan Fund to you.
Great. Well, I'll say that we have been doing a lot of work in the kinds of work that Tanisa just discussed. I mean, supporting unaccompanied minors and trying to support immigrant communities and anti-Islamophobia. But we've been mostly focused in our home, which is New York City, and other cities across the country. What really stood out for us about Tanisa's work is the fact that she's taking this cause to rural America. And quite frankly, you hear all the time that people need to do this work in rural America. You rarely hear somebody that not only is addressing it, but doing it so effectively. So we found, you know, just such inspiration in the work that she's doing. And, you know, just meeting Tanisa, she just really shines a light on the optimism and opportunity that these communities provide to their neighbors. And I feel like we're just so lucky to have a leader like her taking this into rural America, this work. And our hope is that she will really set a model and a pace that other communities can feel like they can follow.
Tanisa, do you think the model is replicable?
I absolutely think it's replicable. I think we have just, you know, similar to what Amy mentioned, people always, the New York City folks, the big city folks, are always talking about, well, how do we do this work in rural America? And what I think South Dakota Voices for Peace has been so successful at is, though we're leading the charge, there's so many people who are following and part of our movement. We really see our work as social change work. You know, we are fighting top-down legislated hate, and we're building bottom up. And really, I don't like to use the word empowering because I think our communities are very resilient, but we're really kind of lifting them from the oppression of the systemic racism and policies that we see through legal services and civic engagement.
I want to tie a couple, if I can jump in, tie a couple of these ideas together because the Dan Kaplan Fund, one of the innovation trends in the fund's 2019 report, as through your press release, Amy, talks about social justice increasingly being led by directly impacted people. And Tanisa, mm-hmm. you mentioned, you know, this early 2017 state legislative session where people who were impacted by the legislation showed up in peer to testify and be in the room. And then we look at this, you know, sort of urban and rural conversation. So much of it, Tanisa, is about showing up and saying, we are here.
Absolutely.
This thing that you have on the piece of paper in front of you, that's me. That's my life. I am that person. I am Muslim.
Right. And I think what was really surprising to me, I had never been to Pierre until 2017, though I've been living here since 2012. Very unengaged with local politics and policies. But when I walked into Pierre, no one looked like me. No one had a faith like mine. No one even seemed to have much empathy towards people who look like me or have different faiths. So I realized just being there, right, and saying, hey, I'm a lawyer, I kind of know about these things, and providing the facts and the myths and just being able to have conversation. You know, our legislators, they really impress upon how they're citizens too. And that has worked in our favor because all it took was having conversations. Because if you think about it, right, we've defeated 80% of the bigoted laws that we've seen in Pierre. The only way we can do that is by reaching across the aisle. So we're showing that having conversations, being present, showing our legislators that all of these communities, though we might not be great in number, that we do exist here and that those laws, if passed, would directly impact us and show them how that would work.
Yeah. And Amy, you mentioned, you know, we talk about sort of making somebody into an other. There's also this other of rural America that in urban areas, in places like New York City, there can be a tendency to just to say, hey, out there in that place we've never set foot, this thing is happening. Talk a little bit about that, if you will, Amy, just sort of taking down those walls of other as it comes to just rural America, places like South Dakota that so much of is rural.
Yeah, well, I'll say that we know here in New York City that we live in our own little bubble. And one of the real joys of this prize has been our ability to reach across the country and network with different sort of groups, and we use community foundations and other folks across the country to help us find the brilliant Tanisas that are out there. And we will say that looking back over three rounds of this prize since 2015, probably some of the most extraordinary successes of this program have been in places that are not in the New York bubble or the LA bubble, or the West Coast bubble, or the East Coast bubble, but really investing in folks across the country where we've learned a lot and we hopefully have brought good resources to them. So I think I have every expectation that Tanisa will outperform again, and not to say that we pit our urban and our rural folks against one another, but there's definitely an opportunity. And I think one of the things that we do as part of the prize is bring our awardees together five or six times during the 3 years of the award, and it really gives them a chance to work as a cohort. And what we realize is sometimes folks working out in rural America don't have easy access to a peer network that shares some of the same challenges and lifting up a new organization and taking on some of these really difficult causes. So I think we find that in many ways we're most effective when we can invest in places that aren't already inundated with resources and philanthropy, and we're excited. And I will just say, and Tanisa doesn't even know this, but I recently attended a conference for communities across the country that are trying to achieve universal representation for the folks in their state that are facing immigrant detention and deportation. And it's clear to me that Tanisa has already had a systemic impact throughout the Dakotas, Minnesota, and that region, and that there's a real network of people, and that, you know, she will just build and build in that network, and we hope to be a part of that.
Tanisa, let's talk about this word network, because earlier in this conversation you mentioned how many, you know, there was legislation that directly targeted immigrants, refugees, Muslims. But then there were these events, and you and I had conversations about these events. We had conversations with people who were, you know, presenting at these events to find out what was going on. But you really found a network in South Dakota of Islamophobia that was organized, which I think was surprising to many people who really hadn't thought about some of these gatherings that were filled with people having presentations that were complete misinformation about the nature of Islam, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been the fascinating part of doing our research. And we have a board member out in Rapid City, Lori Miller, who has taken on that research piece, if you will. But we're really using a model that has been established by the Center for American Progress, and they wrote a national report on Islamophobia and found that there are very specific think tanks, media outlets, grassroots organizations, lawmakers that are part of what they call Fear Inc. And it's Islamophobia and how $57 million have been pumped into this network of organizations and individuals to perpetuate this bigotry and the dehumanization of Muslims, immigrants, and refugees. Because as we know from statistics, some of the communities who are targeted by anti-Muslim hate are in fact not even Muslim. Like the Sikhs who wear turbans, they're not Muslim, but you know, people think they are, and then the hate crime ensues. So Islamophobia for us means all of those things, anti-Muslim, immigrant, and refugee. And we have found that almost all of the pieces of that national report has touched South Dakota in some way. So we have our hate groups here in South Dakota. We have our individuals. We have legislators. We have churches. We have media outlets, all of the same kind of sectors that are in this report here in South Dakota, and we're just building more and more of that information. What I will say is since 2017, we've been very vocal about these events and who these speakers or authors on book tours or whatever are. And we've seen less and less open advertisement of these events, specifically in 2019. So we like to think that our being vocal and bringing attention to who these folks really are is paying off.
And Amy, I want to go back to something that, again, is in the Growing Grassroots Resilience Report on this year's prize as far as trends, and one of them is government is not the enemy of innovation. And as Tanisa was talking about conversations with legislators and lawmakers, what are you seeing, Amy, from a big picture standpoint of how some of these applicants are partnering with government agencies for social challenges?
Well, it's clear that there's certain challenges, many challenges that we face, that there's just no way that philanthropy and just private citizens rolling up their sleeves are going to be able to make the kind of system change that's required. So we sometimes think some of the most daring and innovative projects are those that really take on government and try to find the good in partnership and in partnering with governments. And, I do hope people will download our report, which is at our jmkfund.org website, so they can read more from the grassroots report that you're so kindly referencing. But there is, for example, an effort to work with the National Park Service to build jobs and opportunity for folks to do the really, really careful craftsmanship that keeps our historic fabric intact in America. And the National Park Service has the most expertise in that, but not always the best resources in being able to reach out and find the communities that need the jobs that could come from that training. So we feel like sometimes those are the most creative and daring of projects, but they're not easy, right? Large government agencies, even state government agencies, sometimes even local government agencies can be perplexing. I'm a recovering bureaucrat, so I can say that. But it's truly going to be necessary to build those types of partnerships to make some of the changes that I think we really need to see in our country.
A legislative summer study is passing along a bill that establishes a framework for farmers to grow hemp in South Dakota. It's the group's first meeting since the USDA issued its guidelines for industrial hemp programs. Despite that, some remain opposed to the idea. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
The six-page draft legislation still has a tall hill to climb, but state lawmakers are confident in the bill. It establishes an application process and criminal history check before getting a permit to grow the crop. It also creates a licensure program fund that lawmakers expect to cover the cost of the program. A license to grow hemp will last 15 months. The bill also places groundwork for law enforcement stops and testing. Violation for growing hemp without a permit is a Class 4 felony. Republican State Representative Lee Qualm is chair of the study. He says the bill often refers to federal rules issued by the USDA in October. Now, Qualm says they're urging the department to come up with paperwork that standardizes hemp transportation throughout the United States.
And we are putting that letter forward to USDA. We have until the end of December to make that, you know, set that to them. So we're going to send that out. We're certainly hopeful that they will make that change. And I think it would make it easier for law enforcement in every state to deal with this issue.
Other lawmakers remain opposed to the idea of industrial hemp in South Dakota. Hemp is a cousin to the marijuana plant. Representative Nancy York was the lone no vote against the bill. She says she's still concerned about CBD oil production.
The bill that Representative Qualm put together, well written. It looks like it has a lot of safeguards in it, that inspections will take place on a regular basis, and I think that's all well and good. I think we just might be a year or two ahead of where we want to be in the education process for our farmers.
Governor Kristi Noem, who's been opposed to industrial hemp since last session, was not available for comment on the story. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thank you for listening.